You're listening to a podcast from The Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the podcast from The Rocking Vicar. This is the Parish Council, and I'm Magnus Shaw, and he's a man with a plan with a counterfeit dollar in his hand. He's Terence to come.
Well, it was worth waiting for. Hello there. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Okay, nobody would ever know that was the fourth take at an introduction.
Yes, no, it was the absolute first take, as is every introduction.
As it is every week?
Yes,
absolutely. Yes. No, I'm tip-top form, thanks. And I hope you are too.
Yes, I am, yeah, absolutely. A busy week, but not quite as glamorous as yours. I believe you were hobnobbing with the great and the good yet again.
Oh, yet again. It's tedious, isn't it, really? Yeah, I was at the taping of Later on Tuesday and also there for the live show. The recording is done first, 8 o'clock, and then the allowing for cock-ups and things going wrong, then everybody gets ready for the live show that goes out on, is it BBC Two at 10 o'clock?
Yes. Yes.
And yes, I was, well, I swanned in through the appropriate door of the BBC and found myself at the desk where you report in. And of course, I had to take over. I just can't help myself. What happened was, this young lady was taking the names and ticking them off and handing out passes and so on.
Yeah.
But she got a bit overwhelmed because loads of people all came in at the same time. So there was a spare chair next to her, so I sat down and started asking. I said, "Yes, who's next?" And actually, ticking people off on the guest list.
Well, you're a menace. You're a menace.
This really.
Poor young lady, probably on some graduate placement, trying to check everybody in and out, and there's you acting the goat.
Exactly, especially when people came in that I knew, including the Right Honourable David Hepworth, who said, "What the hell are you doing?" So, yeah, but no, she thanked me. She said I could be her intern for the future because I did help. I did a bit of queue busting.
Right.
At the stage door of Later.
Well, I would suggest, were we lads stood in a pub, God forbid, at this point I would say, well, you're in there then.
Yeah, you would. Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I don't think I'll be invited back, though, by the greater the good, because I probably thought, who the hell's that bloke interfering there?
Once again, blotted your copybook.
Yeah, again.
Yeah.
There I was wearing black, because they tell you have to wear dark clothing.
Oh, yeah, apparently so, yes, yeah.
Yeah, I only found that out when I was invited. I was hanging around by the stage door because the big kerfuffle was that Joey Barton, the Queen's Park Rangers footballer,
was
coming in. And again, I know you're not the world's greatest sporting expert,
no,
but
this is true.
Has 500,000 followers on Twitter, which I saw his replies feed, the messages feed, whatever you call it, Twitter. And if you've got 500,000 followers, it kind of zooms by like a sort of Formula One car flashing past
it
you.
It does, yes, yeah. It's like when you follow a hashtag of something cataclysmic that's happening, and it almost becomes pointless following the hashtag because in TweetDeck it eventually goes too many tweets and stops.
Yes, and stops you. Yeah. And this is why I think sometimes people say, "Oh, I sent a tweet to so and so and they didn't reply."
Yes.
And I think one can only imagine that they probably haven't seen it because
they
really do just scroll past.
Yes. Yeah.
Method that you described. Yes, the Later studio's fantastic. It's a really good experience. I really enjoyed it. Why is it always only girls that have the headsets and the clipboards? The place was full of them. checking your name here and there and listening to people on their headsets and pointing you to there and then saying, "Well, would you mind just moving across to here?" Always girls. There's never men with headsets and clipboards.
Ah, interesting.
But I was reunited with Kevin McCarthy. He's the warm-up man for Jules Holland.
Oh, yes.
It was the first time I've met him since I had a very small, insignificant contribution to the Stuart Lee, Richard Herring Fist of Fun days.
Oh, yeah.
And he was the warm-up man then, so...
I don't mean this to be derogatory. He's made a career out of being a warm-up. I mean, many people have, haven't they? And he's made a career out of doing warm-up, has he?
He does do comedy gigs as well, but it does seem to be his basic living is in warm-ups. But, you know, it's a particular skill, and salary is for a warm-up man, but I assume you do all right out of it.
Yeah, it's a tough gig as well, because absolutely nobody in the building has come to see you, have they?
No, they hadn't. They'd in fact come to see Miles Kane, who hadn't crossed my path before, but he was very good. Laura Marling, The Civil Wars, they were great. If you haven't seen Later yet this week, catch it on iPlayer. Civil Wars, a gal and a bloke.
Yeah.
From Nashville, and they did this absolutely wonderful version of Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, and I got on with them really well because they didn't have a stage. You know, you have those five individual stages that go around the circle. They didn't, and they were just, for their two songs, they were planted just sort of into the middle, really, the centre of where those five stages are. And so in between, they were actually standing next to me, next to the set of Little Roy.
Oh, I see, yes, yeah.
We exchanged a few little words and a little chat. They're really nice people as well, so I naturally warmed to them.
Terrific. Yes, I saw them on Later, and I thought they really shone as well. And it's a great name. The Civil Wars is a terrific name for a band.
It is. Yeah. Little Roy, I thought, was fantastic. This went down great in the studio. I don't know how well it came across on TV. He's done this album. He's a reggae artist, of course. He's done an album of Nirvana songs. Oh my giddy goodness.
Yes.
But actually it worked. I think it worked superbly. And he and his band were fantastic. And probably the best part of my evening was shaking Little Roy's hand. That was
great.
Brilliant.
Excellent. That brings to, do you remember an outfit called Dread Zeppelin?
Yes, Dread Zeppelin. Reggae versions of Zeppelin tunes?
Yeah, exactly, yes. Plus a lead singer called Tort Elvis. So the vocal was in the style of Elvis, as well as there being some reggae and heavy rock melded in there. Yeah, so they had their day in the sun, so I wonder if Little Royce, along that timeline.
It's a cracking idea, isn't it? And so, of course, Tony Bennett was there.
Yeah.
Now, in the studio, he sounded okay, but I was watching tweets live as the live show went out, and there was pretty universal criticism saying that his voice was shot. So I don't know how that came across. If did you see Tony Bennett?
Yes, yes, I did. I thought his voice has been better, but that is absolutely ascribable to his years. One's voice weakens and the older you get, and for a man of his age, he does tremendously. And I thought his performance on Later was great. I think there wasn't a problem as far as I could see.
Yeah, it sounded fine in the studio. As you say, it did sound like the voice of an 85-year-old man, which is what he is. But,
absolutely.
It didn't seem as quite as ragged as perhaps some people were saying. And then, of course, the highlight and the main reason for me being there was the couple of songs by the Silver Seas, who, of course, came across, I thought, tremendously well. And
they are great. And as I was watching them, I was trying to think who they brought to mind, and I'm not sure I've yet nailed exactly who they brought to mind. But there's something of the Squeeze about them, I think. But they're funkier than Squeeze, although Squeeze could be funky given the right song. But they definitely resonate to me, and I still can't right now place exactly who they are like, but
maybe it leads to take that Squeeze analogy.
Yeah, I think there's something there. Maybe Prefab Sprout in there as well. It's those sort of kitchen sink love songs that they do with a really really great pop backing, which brings Prefab Sprout and Squeeze to mind. They're really good, really good.
I hope it's a springboard to more success for them. Of course, they're coming back in the spring for more dates in the UK. The recording was interesting because it showed to me how professional and how sort of clear and the lines are really drawn very straight for the running of the show. They've made 254 episodes of Later.
Have they really?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Yeah. Running without a break since 92. So it ran really, really smoothly. You could tell that that everybody knew what they were doing. Mm-hmm. There were just two cock-ups in the recording, and both were simply technical issues that, something failed. Poor old Laura Marling was halfway through her first song, and we had to cut. And the Civil Wars, their first song, but they dealt with that really, really well. They were really, I suppose, halfway through their first song, and suddenly the floor manager was walking towards them, gesticulating, and so they started continuing the song by commenting on the fact that there was something terribly wrong and that they were going to have to stop, but they kept sort of singing, remarking on the that had gone wrong. Clever moment off the cuff. A fabulous night. I'm always really grateful these days when I go to the BBC Television Centre, which won't be there too much longer, that the enormous shopping mall, Westfield, has been built opposite, because it's now so easy to park. When you go into the Westfield car park, you park at the very extreme end where nobody ever parks, because it's the furthest part from the shops. But it's also the nearest point to the BBC, so you can actually park right on the edge. There's loads of spaces, and it's a two-minute walk across the road, and you're in Television Centre. So, well done, the people behind Westfield Shopping Mall.
Well, that's remarkable parking for London, certainly, isn't it? Yeah,
it's incredible. It's a lovely sort of well-lit mall. Every lane is numbered, so you know where you park.
Yeah.
And it's wide, and you just stroll across. And you're out. Fantastic.
They will get wise to that sooner or later, I think.
None of your BBC types.
No,
here.
You'll have to demonstrate that you've been to Next and Nando's before you can return to your car.
Do you know, it's funny, I've parked in that shopping mall so many times since it's been built, about 2 or 3 years now, and I've never been in it.
No, exactly, this is where you'll get caught out.
You'll have to
prove you have a pair of Primark jeans with you before you can reclaim your car.
Interesting thing, it's not interesting at all, but it struck me as unusual, is that it's one of these places where you pay on exit, so you get given a ticket as you come in, you push a button and the ticket comes out. But the ticket comes out printed with your registration number on it.
Yeah, it's number recognition,
but I didn't realise they had that in car parks now.
So. Oh, yes, because I went to, was it earlier this year? Anyway, it matters not. Flew from John Lennon Airport to the Canary Islands a good few months back, and we'd booked car parking at the airport. Getting into the car park of your choice at different airports is always the different process at each airport. So it's always a bit of a headache. You arrive at the airport, I don't really know what I'm supposed to do now. And we drove into the car park. There's only one car park at John Lennon Airport. It's just a small airport. And as we drove past the barrier, it literally lifted, and there was a box that lit up with our booking on it. Yeah. Said Mr. Shaw, and the registration number, and up the barrier came, and the amount of time that we booked to park there, just because some camera had scanned our number plate. Yeah,
you know what? We're all going to have to get over this business of data protection, because I really do see the future as us having these completely open lives where we don't protect our data, and that everything we do will be known to somebody, if not everybody. I really see that, every day there seems to be a new way of even a machine knowing who you are, where you are, and what you've been doing.
Well, especially a machine. Ooh. Really, I guess. I mean, it always rather freaks me out when I switch my phone on, and it if I hit maps, it knows where we are. Up comes a map with a little dot. So that's right. Obviously, it doesn't know where you are. It knows where itself is. As a phone, it knows where it is, but via a satellite. But that means the phone in your pocket is broadcasting your location to anybody who might need to find it. Yeah, yeah.
We're probably only a few short years away from some device that we're carrying saying, now, you shouldn't really be thinking those thoughts, should you?
Is it a pocket conscience? A digital, yeah. A digital conscience?
Digital conscience.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great album, isn't it? I love Digital Conscience.
Digital Conscience, yes. As you go around the supermarket and you're just reaching out for that king-size Mars bar, your phone says,
Yes, well, and that would be the application, I think, our lords and masters would go for, because they seem to be obsessed with what we're eating, don't they? Concerned about our potential seditionary activities, much more concerned about whether we're having too many chips.
Yes. Oh, have you seen that awful commercial at the moment where a man, a green sort of squidgy man, a bit like Morph, walks around and he's got a spare tyre and it's how he loses his weight.
Mm.
Oh, God, that's grim.
Yes, it's that's Aardman Animations. That is they got the commission to make that. Yes.
Well, I don't mind about the little man who looks a bit like Morph. I'm all for the all for more of Morph. but it's just the patronising message.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No, totally. I do not expect the government of the day to have an interest in my diet, and long may they stay away from my eating habits. That is the strolling into territory which is none of their business. I really do think that's
so that was my evening swanning around the outreaches of Shepherd's Bush and Wood Lane and Dwight Whitty, the country.
Yes, Dwight Whitty, the Hat Act. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
He's on next week, I think. Yeah.
He's on next week's latest, Dwight Whitty.
Just one thing I must ask you about later, and then we'll move on, is what I've always noticed about later, and I've seen some fantastic performances on later, but I've always wondered why they don't drop this particular feature, and that is the Jules Holland interviews bit. I like Jules Holland. He knows his music. He's a bit of a national institution now, and you certainly can't mistake his voice whenever you hear it. But he couldn't interview his way out of a wet paper bag. And I've seen some absolutely shocking interviews that he's done with people who, you know, you tend to wait with bated breath to hear an interview with, you know, people like David Gilmour, and you know, you don't see an interview with people like that every day, by any means at all. And then we have to see the Jules interview. What did he do? One of those? And do you agree? I don't know.
Totally agree. And he did do them. And he interviewed Tony Bennett twice, and with a variation of the same questions on the recorded show and then on the live show.
Yes.
And it was a disaster.
Yeah, yeah, they always are, yeah.
I don't know what it is, whether it's just something he can't do or whether it's a lack of preparation or a lack of briefing, but it seems that it feels as if he's just making up the questions as they occur to him as he sits down, which...
Yeah.
You know, might feel kind of really modern and modish, but it is actually an abject disaster, and it was awful. And he also had a few words with Little Roy as well,
right,
which again was just... It's a shame because, as you say, he's very good at what he does and a very accomplished musician, and he's made that show his own, but it's still very much the weak point, I was going to say the weak link, which would be too much of a pun.
Yes.
It's his lack of interviewing skills.
Excruciating, yes, absolutely. It's,
it was a great moment with Tony Bennett. Again, I was standing with the Civil Wars, and we all kind of looked at each other and raised eyebrows, because Tony Bennett gave two great responses to questions. I think Jules said to him, so, Tony, this duets CD, number one in America. And, you know, where a lot of people say, well, thank you very much. Yes, I believe it is. He said, oh, no, number one all around the world.
Yes.
Which is
absolutely
fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And and in one of the links, I can't remember if it was in the live show or in the recorded show, he said to Tony Bennett, I think he asked him about Aretha in one of the interviews, and then he changed it to Lady Gaga in the other interview. And this is what really, again, the lady from the Civil Wars and I exchanged hugely raised eyebrows at this comment, because Jules said, So, Lady Gaga, how did you get to work with her and find this song? And Tony Bennett went into a few seconds of eulogising Lady Gaga to the point where he actually did say she's going to be bigger than Elvis. And there was a sort of intake of breath around the whole studio. And, as I say, raised eyebrows all around. Well, you know, it's a very nice thing to say, but my giddy aunt, bigger than Elvis.
Yes, hyperbole, perhaps. But I love Tony Bennett. Musically, I enjoy stuff, but just to see him interviewed and shows that he appears on, because he just seems such a smashing fella, doesn't he? He's just a lovely guy.
I can confirm that, because on the way out, he didn't stay to the end. He apparently had another engagement. But as he came out of the studio, all of Little Roy's band shook his hand, and then several of the audience reached out to shake his hand, and although he had not minders with him, but people were guiding him out, he did stop and say thank you very much, thank you, and he did shake his hand, and was generally very pleasant to everybody, and did talk to people, and he didn't play the star at all.
I can believe that, because he always comes across as a warm and charming fella, so I'm pleased to hear that.
Very small fellow.
But often the way with the famous, isn't it? On the odd occasions that I've hobnobbed with the great and the good, I always think, well, you're quite small.
So perhaps
that's why we've never found fame and fortune.
That's probably what it is. We're too tall.
Too tall, that was what it would be.
Stoop.
So it was the television centre that you were at for this shindig, and that's no longer going to be a television venue, is it, under the DQF regime? For those who don't know, DQF is it's quality first. What does the D stand for, Terry?
No, you're absolutely
delivering,
right.
Isn't it?
It's delivering quality first. But you're absolutely right, because I stumble over this all the time. It's a terrible phrase.
Yes.
And I always think, what's the D stand for? Because I always want to say something like putting quality first.
Exactly, delivering.
Delivering quality first. Yeah. It's a really clunky phrase.
So this is the BBC initiative to, it doesn't describe in any shape or form what it's all about. What it's all about is spending 20% less on the BBC across the board, which if anybody's thinking, how does delivering quality first sum that up, you're absolutely right. It doesn't in any shape, way or form, but it is a management speak euphemism for making cuts at the BBC. And it's been posited for most of this year, certainly, hasn't it? We knew that 20% was the figure, but this week out comes the fine detail. And although in theory these are still proposals and have yet to be consulted on, it looks pretty much like this is what they're going to do. And they're not going to axe any particular channels or services, but they are going to take the scalpel to various aspects of all the services that they offer. So, for instance, BBC Local Radio will still exist, but it will share a lot of its services. So, in the East Midlands, BBC Radio Derby, BBC Radio Nottingham, BBC Radio Lincoln, and BBC Radio Leicester will share a lot of their programming. So you will hear the same show whichever city you're in. How that carries the burden of being local, you can only begin to guess, but that's the kind of thing they're going to do. But one of the things that aroused my interest and not a little fury across the various social networks was that Danny Baker's show on BBC Radio London appears to be under extreme threat. Now, the reason this caught my attention was twofold. One, Danny Baker is the finest radio broadcaster currently working in the country, I would say, and has been for many years. And two, his show must be operating on such a low budget that taking it away wouldn't even register on the BBC spreadsheets. So why, would be my question.
I think, first of all of that is absolutely spot on, but I think the Sony award-winning show, I don't think is under any realistic threat at all. I couldn't ever claim to be a close buddy of Danny Baker, but we have occupied the same space. Indeed, I spent an evening with him within the last month, and yeah. I can confirm he likes nothing more than to be impish and to be alarmist. And in his own words, as he said to me on that evening, he's a paper tiger. When challenged, he'll back down and just say, "Whoa, it wasn't me. I was just having a bit of a laugh."
Okay.
I think Danny's got very strong views about the BBC and has very strong political views, which he doesn't air, he doesn't put out on the air at all.
No.
But I don't think it would be a surprise to many to know what those views are. So I think he was really reflecting that. The reality is that certainly the BBC London show, I really don't think is under any real threat
okay.
at all. I could be proven wrong, of course, but there will be some sort of, as they say in these DQF worlds, some rationalisation of local radio.
Yes.
But, in other words, cuts. But I would think the more likely option is, if there is some sort of regionalisation, that it'll be going outwards from Danny Baker's show, where that might be taken by the Surrey and the
okay.
Kent areas,
right.
if you like, rather than the other way being imposed. It's possible that Bobby Elm's show could be reviewed, because that's very London centric.
Yes,
but
Danny's isn't,
and there is David Robey, the head man at BBC Radio London, has made some odd decisions over the years, but I think even he would know that axing Danny's afternoon show would lead to riots in Marylebone.
Well, yeah.
I just don't see it as feasible, and I think Danny kind of implied later in the day that he was being somewhat impish
okay.
with it all. Because it was, there was a few lines for some good gags in his Twitter feed there about him burning his Sony Awards down the end of the garden and all this sort of thing.
Yeah,
I think he likes a bit of a storm sometimes.
Well, apart from anything else, they're getting a stupendous bargain, aren't they? With Baker. I mean, when we think how much Chris Moyles is paid for his efforts, and I know he has a large audience and he serves a purpose, but I think it would be a brave person who would suggest that Moyles was anything like in the same league as a broadcaster as Baker. And by all accounts, Danny Baker costs them little more than a bottle of Tizer and a pat on the head, doesn't he?
The fees at Radio London are extraordinarily low. Again, some may think, it must be coining it in, presenting a show from the heart of the metropolis. It's actually got a tiny budget.
Yes.
And, certainly, I have a friend who presented a show on Radio London in the late 80s. They got 40 quid per show. I did some freelance production there in the mid 80s, and I think I got £75
yeah.
for 3 hours. And what I will say is, okay, they have gone up somewhat since then, but not a great deal.
No.
We're not talking thousands of pounds per show. And certainly the if we call them sidekicks that
yes.
Danny has in Balin, Amy, David Quo and so on, again, I think people would be astonished to know how low the fee is those guests receive to contribute on that show. So it certainly won't be for money. I think you're absolutely right about local radio. The example I have is, of course, more local to me here. I was looking this up yesterday as a result of some of those proposed changes under delivering quality first, which is the fact that out towards my way, Berkshire Way, there's 24 miles between Reading, the city of Reading and the city of Oxford.
Yes.
24 miles between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's BBC Berkshire and BBC Oxfordshire.
Yeah.
And, realistically, if you are looking to save money, and I'm not saying, in a great, fantastic, ideal world, it wouldn't be handy to have two separate stations. But when there's 24 miles between the studios and you're looking to save money, do we really need two fully manned stations when there's less than 25 miles between them? And again, it's not like the 24 miles between Dover and Calais.
Mm.
I speak the same language in Oxford as they do in Reading, and well, share pretty much the same issues, you know?
Yes. Yeah, I don't know. Having stood at Oxford Station and Reading Station on my travels, I'm not entirely sure they do speak the same language, but... but I take your point, yeah. Yeah, obviously, you know, if you have a radio network like the BBC Local Radio Network, you have to review it almost all the time because needs and wants and purposes change. Sharing content, it becomes problematic. I mentioned the East Midlands, and that's a different kettle of fish because if you're going to make Radio for Derby seem very local, you can't really share programming with Lincoln. I mean, there's many miles between the two cities, and the issues and stories and relatable events are completely different. So the local tag starts to become a bit meaningless.
Well, I think there is an awareness of that, and I think there's potentially two ways around it. I feel the first and more likely and more well-known one is the fact that it will seem that the BBC local stations will follow the way that the commercial stations have gone over the last year, which is to have unique breakfast and drive time shows so that you can run travel and have a local aspect to the really key shows, mm-hmm. and only share the content during the day, and perhaps later in the evening, when that localism isn't quite so much part of the focus. So if you've got a traffic build-up in Lincoln during the rush hour, the people in Derby wouldn't be hearing about that, but they'd be hearing about the Derby issues.
Yeah.
The other one, which is, you know, as technology moves forward, and I think you'll be able to explain this to us because of your radio show and the way that your radio station works, is that there's a possibility of using voice tracking for some of these programs, whether shared or not, mm-hmm. where a presenter will actually pre-record or even live if it's viable, if it's, you know, music-based show, record different segments. It's the same show, but there are different segments going out at the same time in your example, Derby and Lincoln.
Yeah, the radio station I, Park Cohen, and work with is an internet radio station, and we use voice tracking. For those who don't know, voice tracking is simply the show chopped up into sound files, music, jingles, and presenter, which the computer then compiles at broadcast time in real time and transmits. We use that occasionally. The whole station is not voice tracked, so I would say about 10% of the station perhaps is voice tracked, and we use it on some of the specialist shows where simply because they go out in the evening, it allows the presenter to have some kind of a family life, in that they can come and put the show together in, you know, office hours, and then be at home when it's transmitted. And that's okay for specialist shows because the music that they are talking about and playing, and then the information they have is still, you know, highly pertinent just a few hours later when the computer compiles and puts the show out. And that's a bit different from daytime programming, like you say, breakfast and drive time, where the information has to sort of be very local and be very much in real time. And I think, you know, yes, if breakfast and drive time are maintained as local, that's good. But I also think, you know, that afternoons, if you're going to have a local radio station, the afternoon show really does need to be locally focused and in real time. And that seems to be what might disappear.
It possibly and very likely will, but I don't fully agree with you that that's crucial, the afternoon show. Again, your Derby and Lincoln thing and my Reading and Oxford business. I can't imagine that if a story goes out on, say, let's link Berkshire and BBC Oxfordshire, if a story goes out about a story that's breaking in Oxford, I don't think Reading people will necessarily turn off in droves. It's as I say, it's only 20 odd miles away, so it is part part of their world.
Yeah.
I think much of these changes, and I think this is the positive aspect of it, mm-hmm. much of these changes, the listener and the viewer probably won't notice very much.
Okay.
For example, one of the savings, this makes a great deal of sense, I can't imagine anybody disagreeing with this, is that the news output of Radio 1 and yes. Radio 1 Extra is going to be merged. Now, it's insanity that they had two separate news streams.
Yes, that's true. That is true,
and I think many of these changes are those... We talked about this some months ago when John Myers did his report.
Yeah.
And much of the DQF actually does reflect some of his recommendations. And another one where I think, perhaps some people may say, oh dear, I'll miss that, but on the BBC News channel during the day, instead of having two presenters doing that sort of table tennis, bing bong, ping pong
yes.
thing, there'll just be one reading the script.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
Is that going to break anybody's hearts?
No, it actually might avert some of the more excruciating exchanges that seem to happen on these things.
Exactly. Those embarrassing, cringy moments when... they say, well, there's an item on toast. Now, I believe you like a slice of toast in the morning.
Yes. Yeah. The kind of thing that Chris Morris was spoofing about 20-odd years ago, wasn't he?
And maybe...
Remember... Go on.
No, I was just going to say, maybe BBC 3 and BBC 4 do need to be refocused somewhat, because I certainly... don't know exactly what they stand for, what they're there. They just seem to be add-ons. And so if they're given a focus so that they play a more supportive role to the networks, then
yes.
a good thing. Sorry, you were going to give us a story about Chris Morris.
Well, it just sort of brings to mind the moment on... it might not have been the day-to-day, actually. It must have been On the Hour, which was the radio version, where Chris Morris, playing the news anchor, tries to do one of these sort of chummy chats with Alan Partridge. when Alan Partridge was only a bit character on those programmes. And he says... he's done an item about Cream, and he does exactly what you said. He says, and I understand, Alan... you like Cream. I certainly do, Chris. I certainly like a bit of Cream. Sport! and that's kind of how these things play out, isn't it? So
it really is.
Yeah.
That kind of, you feel your cheeks going red on their behalf.
Indeed, yes. But on a sort of a more broader level, with DQF, which I'm going to make a point of resisting using too often, are they pointing the cannon at the right areas of the BBC? They're going to have to do this. So are the decisions reasonable, do you think, so far?
Yes, I think so, because I think the great fear of everybody was that one particular channel or channels were going to be shut down, and as you said, I think in the introduction, they have avoided that through,
mm-hmm.
you've got that other phrase that people love so much, which is salami slicing. So in other words, they're slicing bits off everything.
Okay.
Salami slicing, my
yes.
So if in doing so, the greater sharing of the news bulletins across the stations, and well, I think one of the things which actually could bring us back to the only perhaps possibility of the Danny Baker bit coming back into play is that they're particularly stressing that they want 5 Live to focus on its core output of news and sport.
Okay.
Now, Danny's mid-morning show on 5 Live probably does neither. So whether, there's a sort of hidden message there.
Okay.
But then again, this has been Danny Baker's issue all through his career, is the BBC want him, but they're never quite sure what to do with him and where to put him. And this is why he often falls out with them, because as soon as they start to try and make his programme conform,
mm-hmm.
that's when the wheels come off.
Yeah.
But no, I think in general, it does seem to make sense. It's hard news for, it's difficult for example, on radio, the Asian network, a big reduction for them, 34% reduction in its spending.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as well, some older listeners will worry about the changes that the distribution costs of medium wave and long wave in particular. I think they're looking in the long term to downscale and perhaps lose the long wave service for Radio 4. The worst of it, of course, is that for all we're saying all these changes will be okay, there's still going to be 2,000 people, including an awful lot of news journalists, that are going to lose their jobs, and there's never any satisfaction from that, and we all know how hard it is to get any work in the media at the moment, so, you know, that's not a good thing. But aside from that, as I say, I don't think many people will notice. I think reducing the red button transmissions, again, you know, I the take-up on that is so low.
Yes, it must be, yes, yes.
So, you know, it will affect some people, but not that many. And, you know, they are reducing things across the board, reviewing. Even Radio 3, the BBC's orchestras and singers and original drama and so on. So the pain is being shared.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on it. Now, sad news this week. The founder and former CEO of Apple, not the Beatles record label, but the enormous computer and device company, Steve Jobs, died this week. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think what's maybe as little as 15 years ago, we didn't recognize that digital devices, we can't even say computers now really, but digital devices were going to have such a revolutionary impact on the world in which we lived. We just noticed that, you know, when we went into work, the thing plonked on our desk was progressively getting slightly more sophisticated, but it was such a minor part of our lifestyle. And then before we knew it, it actually, these machines were integral to our lives. They were not running our lives, but they were embedded in our lives in a way it would be hard to imagine not having now. And Steve Jobs was largely responsible for this, wasn't he?
He was. I think by the time I've finished saying the next two or three sentences, I can feel people will be rushing to their computers to send complaints in.
Okay.
About to say.
Right.
But I'm going to say it anyway.
Yeah, please do.
We need to make a difference between exactly what you said, of which not one word I would dispute, and the influence of Apple, and particularly, of course, Steve Jobs in his life and his work. It is fantastic what's been achieved. But I believe his death, of course, is awful, it's sad, but it's a matter for his family and those, his friends close to him and those who worked with him. And I feel we've got the danger again of, for some reason, in latter years, we've developed as a world almost this maudlin Diana J. Goody kind of deification of people when they die. And I say this because I saw pictures of people leaving half-eaten apples outside the Apple store in Covent Garden, and flowers and candles, and people outside Steve Jobs' home on the west coast of America placing tea-like candles in the shape of an apple and his name.
Yes.
And I just think, you know, leave the grieving to his family and his friends and those who know him.
Yes.
Certainly we can say all the fantastic things that have happened technically through his work and his innovation and so on. But I would like to leave a bit of a distance between this making people godlike characters when they die.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And I think death cults do spring up around figures. And I suspect it is almost not that people can't possibly be grieving for Steve Jobs or for Jade Goody or for Diana because they didn't know them and weren't related to them. So there's no genuine grief taking place, and I think it's perhaps an offshoot of the cult of celebrity, in that by leaving a candle outside the Apple store in Covent Garden or you know, equally leaving a bunch of flowers outside Kensington Palace, people somehow feel that they have drawn themselves closer to somebody famous, and that some of that sort of acclaim and celebrity might rub off on them as a result. I don't think they're doing this consciously, but I think that's subconsciously what is probably taking place. I have never gone and laid anything to a famous person when they've died, and I would find the you know, the activity empty and hollow and a sham. And I didn't know Steve Jobs. Indeed, I had to read a lot about Steve Jobs' life after his death this week, just to acquaint myself with some of the things that he'd said and done. So I completely agree with you about this this sort of maudlin death cult that springs up when famous people die. But I do think when somebody like Steve Jobs dies, what it does give us an opportunity to do is reflect on what he has achieved, because he won't be achieving anything further. And so his canon of work is complete, if you like, and it's always interesting to reflect on, you know, that then now complete portfolio of achievements. It does serve that purpose.
Yeah, oh, yes, I don't want to take away from that at all. As I say, his achievements, his life and work within Apple and the other corporations that within which he worked, you know, fantastic, and genuinely has, again, as you rightly said, changed our lives forever in the way that we interact with each other. And I have an iPhone, and to be honest with you, I can't imagine life without it.
Well, precisely, yeah, yes,
say, really,
yeah.
And so, you know, it was his company that brought that to us. It's interesting though that he has had something of a charmed life in the media, because you know, there've been reports and still remain issues about the what appear to be terrible conditions at the factory in Shenzhen.
That's right, yeah.
Where iPhones are made.
Yeah. And, I think the iPad, isn't it, that's made there?
Is it the iPad?
I think it's the iPad that's made there, yes.
You know, there's a factory over there where, you know, it seems, again, I can't confirm this, but there's certainly charges of absolutely dreadful conditions for the workers.
Yeah, there. So I did a piece on this, absolutely this subject, maybe a year ago, for a website called Creative Pool. And what struck me when I was researching that piece as being incredible was that this factory seemed to be taking great pride in the fact that they had managed to bring down their suicide rate. Can you imagine a workplace having a recorded suicide rate?
Oh, my goodness.
And they were sort of defending their position by saying that, oh, yes, in the last 12 months, we've radically reduced our at-work suicide rate. And this is not workers who happen to have committed suicide. These are people who have killed themselves in the workplace. That sort of speaks volumes, doesn't it? And, yeah, and Apple have some of their products made there because the labour is cheap, and you know, the end product is good, and that's why it's important not to deify people like Steve Jobs, because they are flawed and they are capitalists, and therefore will look to you know, quick and easy ways to make large amounts of money. And Apple are no different from that, despite the fact that they've conjured up a very sort of touchy-feely Ben and Jerry style public image and brand for themselves. They quite often put themselves in tricky situations, and that was certainly one case. Yeah.
Well, I think it's absolutely extraordinary that again, I didn't realise quite the degree of concern about this factory, which I think I will research a little more, especially after what you said, and I'll read what you presented in that other article, because it is then amazing that shame, if you like, hasn't reached Steve Jobs and his reputation.
Yeah, well, the Apple Inc. have an enormous and very effective PR operation. The Apple brand is as much what they're selling as circuitry. People choose Apple products for not solely because they operate so well. They are buying into something that the Apple brand represents, and Apple have been extremely good at building that. Certainly, when measured against Microsoft, who are viewed as an inconvenience by their users, I think, and Apple are viewed as almost a religious fervour by their users, and that doesn't happen by accident. You know, that is built and protected very concertedly, you know.
So this is why I say, you know, we need in these difficult times to differentiate between the man and his family and his friends who would, of course, be going through a terrible time.
Quite so, yeah.
Poor children. And the reality of what's actually going on within the business, and they're two very separate things.
Yes, no, quite so. Yeah, yeah. But it's undeniable, I think, that his work has changed a lot of our lives and the world. Whether it's been for the better or not is for other people to decide, but he has made a huge impact on the world in which we live. Before we go, we must just talk about dear old Robert Zimmerman, who's got himself into a bit of a pickle. It's quite a funny story, really, after the heaviosity of talking about Steve Jobs. Bob Dylan has always had as long as I can remember, a side career, as well as being a nasally challenged folk singer. He's been a painter. A lot of rock stars do this, don't they? They either fancy themselves as actors or painters. And indeed, I think his self-portrait is on the front of a Bob Dylan album, but
If I'm not mistaken, it's called Self-Portrait.
Is it? The album's called Self-Portrait. Well, there you go, you see. He's obviously been at this for a while, which is fine, you know. I've seen some of his art, and it doesn't impress me terrifically, but there you go. He's perfectly entitled to slap a bit of gouache around on a canvas and show it us. No problem with that at all. Where he's come unstuck is actually funny, isn't it, that a lot of these rock stars who become artists always go for abstract art, because I think they think, yeah, that's quite easy, isn't it? This sort of interpretative art, you know, if they have to draw a tree and it has to look like perfectly like a tree, I think they'd shy away. But, you know, anyway, I digress. So Bob Dylan, yeah, he's in the words of Boney M, a painter man. And what he's done this time, though, is he's opened an exhibition in a gallery in New York. And I think for the first time, his pictures are quite literal in that in that they kind of look like what they're supposed to be. Anybody who's seen the cover of Self-Portrait will realise he's not always gone for that approach in the past. but what has come to light is that a percentage, if not all, of these pictures that he is currently exhibiting are taken from easy-to-find photographs, professionally taken, that are Googleable. So what appears to have happened is that he's trawled the net, saving photos that he's liked the look of, and then he's either blown them up and painted over them, or he's used his eye to copy what he's seen. That's a valid art project if you say that's what you've done. He hasn't. And now there's a big question mark over Bob the artist. Your comments, please.
I love the fact that originally at this gallery in New York, the Gagosian Gallery, the show was actually originally billed as a visual journal of Dylan's travels Japan, China, Vietnam, and South Korea, and, quote, with first-hand depictions of people, street scenes, architecture, and landscape.
Yeah, so not only has he not acknowledged his painting over a photo, he's actually saying that this is where he's been. He's not just maintained a steely silence to cover up his naughtiness. He's actually claimed something quite the opposite, that he was stood there doing it.
That description, I believe, has now been removed by the gallery.
Well, who'd have thunk?
It's fantastic, because any lawyers listening, I'm sure he did not do this, okay, lawyers? He didn't do this.
No, I'm sure.
You could almost believe that he had gone in there, gone into, got hold of these photographs and got a big sheet of tracing paper.
Yes.
And traced over the lines and then coloured in.
Yeah.
A la painting by numbers. As I say, lawyers, he of course did not do that. What is the astonishing part is that if you look at the cover of the self-portrait album, which is, I'm sure, easily Googleable, it does look like a kindergarten, three-year-old class cumulatively come together and daubed some paint on a piece of card, and miraculously you can just about make out it's the face of a man.
Mostly the nose of a man, really, isn't it?
The nose of a man. Yeah. Where a teacher would say, well, that's a very good...
Bob.
well done, Robert. And so thus, 40 years later, he may have improved, but his style, it's, I suppose one would call it naive.
yeah, indeed.
It does appear that his actual skills for actually putting paint onto a canvas and making it look like something have improved so dramatically from 1970s wildlife that, we would come back and say, of course, if we didn't know better,
yes,
we would always go with the tracing paper and filling in the gaps idea.
Yes.
Just looking at them now, that's why I've become a bit distracted, because I'm looking at the Bob Dylan's painting Opium, and this photograph by Leon Bussy in 1915, titled Woman Smoking Opium.
Oh, yes, okay.
It's absolutely remarkable, the everything, including the scale and the objects all around, appear to be exact facsimiles.
Yes. What are the chances of Bob encountering that exact scene that the painter saw? It is a remarkable piece of synchronicity there. And of course, the title of the picture, there are some almost imperceptible cross references between the two titles, aren't there?
I didn't notice there. Let me just have a look again. The photograph is called Woman Smoking Opium.
Yeah, and Bob's
his painting is called Opium. No, I can't see a link.
No, there's some resonance between the two, isn't there?
But
it's subtle, very subtle. I wonder if you remember a device from, certainly from my childhood. In your childhood you played with pebbles outside a cave, didn't you? But in my childhood we had a toy that was, you put a pencil in one end, and then between you and the pencil was like a concertina type affair, like a lattice thing. And then at your end, there was a plastic pointer. I'm describing this really badly. But
you are describing it really badly.
It's like a crocodile thing. I mean, a crocodile that expands and contracts, And you place the pencil on a piece of paper and the plastic pointer, on a picture.
Yeah.
Perhaps woman smoking opium, for instance.
Perhaps.
You trace the lines of the picture with the plastic pointer, and by some... I think there was a pin that gave you a pivot. And by some... a mathematical miracle, the pencil would start drawing what you were outlining. Do you remember this thing?
I do, yes.
Yeah. Thank goodness for that. I'm glad you
there. Hey, 10 minutes. Yeah. Are the listeners still awake? Wake up, everybody. It's finished now.
Yeah.
You drafted your plastic pointer around the picture, and it translated it with a weighted pencil onto a black sheet of paper.
Yeah, it didn't work terribly well ever, I seem
badly,
to recall.
Yes.
Yeah, it worked badly. But I wonder if, perhaps rooting around in his loft amongst the untold acoustic guitars and Valentine's cards from Joan Baez, old Bobstick came across his old snaky pencil-y machine and
please don't describe it again, please.
No, and decided to give it a further go. If lawyers are listening, this never happened.
Either that or he has an old etch-a-sketch. machine. Do you remember that? The Etch-a-Sketch.
They were rubbish.
They were terrible.
Yeah, there is a website where people have used an Etch-a-Sketch to recreate an album cover, which is most entertaining, I have to say. But they were rubbish. They were sort of the computer you didn't have to plug in, weren't they?
They were. And wasn't it that you were just about to finish your stick man, which is probably about...
All you could draw.
Yeah. That the slightest nudge of the thing used to clear it. Yeah. So that all your hard work, an hour getting an arm and a leg to look even vaguely realistic.
Yeah, you could only go up and down and side to side, couldn't you?
Yeah.
With two wheels. If you twisted simultaneously, you'd get a wiggly line, but not with any degree of accuracy. And, like you say, the slightest motion, and indeed, I think the revolution of the Earth was something to clear, wouldn't it?
Gravity took hold.
Yeah, if you were Tom, you could just about write your name, but I, as you know, was called Magnus, so I never got to the end of my name before the damn thing cleared. So, that was a rubbish toy.
It was the sort of Christmas gift that by 11 o'clock on Christmas morning would be under the sofa.
Yeah, did you ever smash one?
No. What happens? Lots of iron filings come trickling out.
Much better fun when you break one, because, yes, it's full of exceedingly highly glittering silvery powder, which you could then sort of throw in the air and allow the sunlight to catch it, and then receive a hiding from one's parents for covering the front room in silvery powder. Yeah. Probably asbestos, I would have thought.
Probably, although, again, any lawyers listening, he is, of course, meaning it wasn't.
When I say it was asbestos in the Etch-a-Sketch, what I mean is it wasn't asbestos in the Etch-a-Sketch.
Actually, that sounds far more fun.
Oh, it was, accidentally, in inverted commas, treading on it revealed, at least 10 minutes of fun, which was more than the intact version ever provided. So,
when you first started describing the thing where you trace round with a plastic pen, I thought you were going to talk about, was it called Spirogyra?
Oh, Spirogyra.
Is that what it was called? Do you remember that?
No, I've done this. Here we go. Sit yourself down, Terence.
Okay.
Spirogyra is pondweed. It's also the name of a progressive rock jazz outfit who had one hit, the name of which escapes me. What you're thinking of is the Spirograph.
Spirograph, that's it. Yeah. Yeah. What did I say? Spirogyra. That's like my twit Westy or whatever I said.
Spirograph was absolutely rubbish as well. What Spirograph was a smart boy's toy, wasn't it? It was like if you had a guy in the class who was always sort of building his own go-kart or solving Fermat's Last Theorem, he would be very good at Spirograph and would produce pictures that his parents would frame and put on the wall. If you were just a snotty tow rag like myself, after three or four attempts of making these cogs draw pictures, it suddenly dawned on you that whilst you were very young, your life was ebbing away in front of you. And you'd go and seize your action man with great gusto and go and do something more useful, like throw soil bombs at your action man. So,
of course, it was aimed at boys, but it always seemed to me to be more of a girly thing.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was. And you'll forgive me, listeners, a right ball ache the Spirograph was. You had to put cogs within cogs and then push them around with a pencil, and it created geometric patterns. To what end, I do not know. Throwing soil at action men was far more entertaining, in a different league of entertainment from that.
And the end result turned up what would be sort of like recuperation for LSD suffering,
didn't it? Yes, it was. Bring your mate off acid with Spirograph. Yeah. If lawyers are listening, there was no correlation between psychedelic drugs and the use of the spirograph. Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, it was rubbish. I hated the spirograph. Absolutely hated it. And if you went round to somebody's house, this death actually happened to me, and you'd arrive, and the mum of your friend would say, hello, Magnus. Nice to see you. We're doing spirograph, and there'd be a table laid out with paper and pens and these bloody cogs. And I think, oh, Christ, I was rather hoping for a bike ride, you know. So, it wasn't.
And the kids that use those probably all now mechanical engineers and surveyors and so on.
Yeah, or acid casualties.
Yeah, absolutely. And these were the kids that used these other rubbish toys, like Meccano to make a go-kart or a steep. Or something. Meccano was always
here. Well. Anything that adults would sort of whoop in approval when you produced the end result was off my agenda, I'm afraid. I liked things that made a mess or represented spaceships or war. And that adults would stand scratching their heads to try and figure out why you'd spent 3 hours doing what you'd been doing. If adults understood it, and even worse, thought it was tremendous, then I didn't want to.
Generally off limits. You couldn't fight the American Civil Wars with a spirograph, it's true.
No, that's absolutely true. Or recreate the holodeck of the Starship Enterprise. Which are the kind of things I liked to do. So anyway, on that subject, and I'm sure we can return to rubbish childhood toys at a later date. So, yeah, anyway, good luck with the art, Bob. You know, we wish you well. Look forward to the next exhibition. And, keep up with the tracing paper. No, there's no tracing
paper. No tracing
paper. No tracing paper. But my bathroom could do with a lick of eggshell. So if you happen to be in the East Midlands, do bring your stuff round. And we'll look forward to having a new bathroom at your expense. That's it. We're over time, Mr. T. Thank you very much for your contribution this week. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
See you soon.
See you soon. Bye-bye. And thanks very much to you at home or wherever you happen to be listening for listening. This has been the Rocking Vicars Parish Council for another week, and we will see you in 7 days. This has been a Dacom Shaw Media production. Bye-bye.
Early one morning the sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed at all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress, papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue.
Oh, yes, got it. Right, okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hello, go on. Let's go again. Stumbled the first word. Here we go again. 3, 2, 1.